Chapter 2. Peasants say there's one day in the year when a lot of dogs appear there, and that day the keeper and his daughter go off to Morlaix and get drunk. The women in Brittany drink dreadfully. She stooped to match a silk, then she lifted her charming inquisitive Parisian face. Colon, did you really see a lot of dogs? There isn't one at Kerfel, she said. 2. Landravane, the next day, hunted out a shabby calf volume from the back of an upper shelf of his library. Yes, here it is. What does it call itself? A History of the Assizes of the Duchy of Brittany. Quimper, 1702. The book was written about 100 years later than the Kerfel affair, but I believe the account is transcribed pretty literally from the judicial records. Anyhow, it's queer reading. And there's a Herve de Landravane mixed up in it, not exactly my style, as you will see. But then he's only a collateral. Here, take the book up to bed with you. I don't exactly remember the details, but after you've read it, I'll bet anything you'll leave your light burning all night. I left my light burning all night, as he had predicted. But it was chiefly because, till near dawn, I was absorbed in my reading. The account of the trial of Anne de Cornault, wife of the Lord of Kerfel, was long and closely printed. It was, as my friend had said, probably an almost literal transcription of what took place in the courtroom, and the trial lasted nearly a month. Besides, the type of the book was detestable. At first I thought of translating the old record literally. But it is full of wearisome repetitions, and the main lines of the story are forever straying off into side issues. So I have tried to disentangle it, and give it here in a simpler form. At times, however, I have reverted to the text, because no other words could have conveyed so exactly the sense of what I felt at Kerfel, and nowhere have I added anything of my own. 3. It was in the year 16 that Yves de Cornault, lord of the domain of Kerfel, went to the pardon of Locrinan to perform his religious duties. He was a rich and powerful noble, then in his 62nd year, but hale and sturdy, a great horseman and hunter and a pious man. So all his neighbors attested. In appearance he seems to have been short and broad, with a swarthy face, legs slightly bowed from the saddle, a hanging nose and broad hands with black hairs on them. He had married young, and lost his wife and son soon after, and since then had lived alone at Kerfel. Twice a year he went to Morlaix, where he had a handsome house by the river, and spent a week or 10 days there, and occasionally he rode to Rennes on business. Witnesses were found to declare that during these absences he led a life different from the one he was known to lead at Kerfel, where he busied himself with his estate, attended mass daily, and found his only amusement in hunting the wild boar and waterfowl. But these rumors are not particularly relevant, and it is certain that among people of his own class in the neighborhood he passed for a stern, and even austere man, observant of his religious obligations, and keeping strictly to himself. There was no talk of any familiarity with the women on his estate, though at that time the nobility were very free with their peasants. Some people said he had never looked at a woman since his wife's death. But such things are hard to prove, and the evidence on this point was not worth much. Well, in his 62nd year, Yves de Cornault went to the pardon at Locrinan, and saw there a young lady of Douarnenez, who had ridden over pillion behind her father to do her duty to the saint. Her name was Anne de Berrigan, and she came of good old Breton stock, but much less great and powerful than that of Yves de Cornault. And her father had squandered his fortune at cards, and lived almost like a peasant in his little granite manor on the moors. I have said I would add nothing of my own to this bald statement of a strange case, but I must interrupt myself here to describe the young lady who rode up to the lych gate of Locrinan at the very moment when the Baron de Cornault was also dismounting there. I take my description from a rather rare thing. A faded drawing in red crayon, sober and truthful enough, to be by a late pupil of the Clouets, which hangs in Landravane's study, and is said to be a portrait of Anne de Berrigan. It is unsigned, and has no mark of identity, but the initials AB, and the date 16, the year after her marriage. It represents a young woman with a small oval face, almost pointed, yet wide enough for a full mouth with a tender depression at the corners. The nose is small, and the eyebrows are set rather high, far apart, and as lightly penciled as the eyebrows in a Chinese painting. The forehead is high and serious, and the hair, which one feels to be fine and thick and fair, drawn off it, and lying close like a cap. The eyes are neither large nor small, hazel probably, with a look at once shy and steady. A pair of beautiful long hands are crossed below the lady's breast. The chaplain of Kerfel, and other witnesses, avert that when the baron came back from Locrin and he jumped from his horse, ordered another to be instantly saddled, called to a young page come with him, and rode away that same evening to the south. His steward followed the next morning with coffers laden on a pair of pack mules. The following week Yves de Cornel rode back to Kerfel, sent for his vassals and tenants, and told them he was to be married at All Saints to Anne de Berrigan of Douarnenez. And on All Saints' Day the marriage took place. As to the next few years, the evidence on both sides seems to show that they passed happily for the couple. No one was found to say that Yves de Cornault had been unkind to his wife, and it was plain to all that he was content with his bargain. Indeed, it was admitted by the chaplain and other witnesses for the prosecution that the young lady had a softening influence on her husband, and that he became less exacting with his tenants, less harsh to peasants and dependents, and less subject to the fits of gloomy silence which had darkened his widowhood. As to his wife, the only grievance her champions could call up in her behalf was that Kerfel was a lonely place, and that when her husband was away on business at Rennes or Morlaix, whither she was never taken, she was not allowed, so much as to walk in the park unaccompanied. But no one asserted that she was unhappy, though one servant woman said as he had surprised her crying, and had heard her say that she was a woman accursed to have no child, and nothing in life to call her own. But that was a natural enough feeling in a wife attached to her husband, and certainly it must have been a great grief to Yves de Cornault that she gave him no son. Yet he never made her feel her childlessness as a reproach. She herself admits this in her evidence, but seemed to try to make her forget it by showering gifts and favors on her. Rich though he was, he had never been open-handed, but nothing was too fine for his wife, in the way of silks or gems or linen, or whatever else she fancied. Every wandering merchant was welcome at Kerfel, and when the master was called away he never came back without bringing his wife a handsome present, something curious, and particular from Morlaix or Rennes or Quimper. One of the waiting women gave, in cross-examination, an interesting list of 1 year's gifts, which I copy. From Morlaix, a carved ivory junk, with Chinamen at the oars, that a strange sailor had brought back as a votive offering for Notre Dame de la Clarte, above Plaumenic. From Quimper, an embroidered gown, worked by the nuns of the Assumption. From Rennes, a silver rose that opened, and showed an amber virgin with a crown of garnets. From Morlaix, again, a length of Damascus velvet shot with gold, bought of a Jew from Syria. And for Michaelmas that same year, from Rennes, a necklet or bracelet of round stones, emeralds, and pearls and rubies strung like beads on a gold wire. This was the present that pleased the lady best, the woman said. Later on, as it happened, it was produced at the trial, and appears to have struck the judges and the public as a curious and valuable jewel. The very same winter, the baron absented himself again, this time as far as Bordeaux, and on his return he brought his wife something even odder and prettier than the bracelet. It was a winter evening when he rode up to Kerfel, and, walking into the hall, found her sitting listlessly by the fire, her chin on her hand, looking into the fire. He carried a velvet box in his hand, and, setting it down on the hearth, lifted the lid, and let out a little golden brown dog. Anne de Cornault exclaimed with pleasure as the little creature bounded toward her. H, It looks like a bird or a butterfly, she cried as she picked it up. And the dog put its paws on her shoulders and looked at her with eyes like a Christian's. After that she would never have it out of her sight, and pet it and talk to it, as if it had been a child, as indeed it was the nearest thing to a child she was to know. Yves de Cornault was much pleased with his purchase. The dog had been brought to him by a sailor from an East India merchantman, and the sailor had bought it of a pilgrim in a bazaar at Jaffa, who had stolen it from a nobleman's wife in China. A perfectly permissible thing to do, since the pilgrim was a Christian, and the nobleman a heathen doomed to hellfire. Yves de Cornault had paid a long price for the dog, for they were beginning to be in demand at the French court, and the sailor knew he had got hold of a good thing. But Anne's pleasure was so great that, to see her laugh and play with the little animal, her husband would doubtless have given twice the sum. So far, all the evidence is at one, and the narrative plain sailing, but now the steering becomes difficult. I will try to keep as nearly as possible to Anne's own statements, though toward the end, poor thing. Well, to go back. The very year after the little brown dog was brought to Kerfel, Yves de Cornault, one winter night, was found dead at the head of a narrow flight of stairs leading down from his wife's rooms to a door opening on the court. It was his wife who found him, and gave the alarm, so distracted, poor wretch, with fear and horror, for his blood was all over her, that at first the roused household could not make out what she was saying, and thought as he had gone suddenly mad. But there, sure enough, at the top of the stairs lay her husband, stone dead, and head foremost, the blood from his wounds dripping down to the steps below him. He had been dreadfully scratched and gashed about the face and throat, as if with a dull weapon, and one of his legs had a deep tear in it which had cut an artery, and probably caused his death. But how did he come there, and who had murdered him? His wife declared that as he had been asleep in her bed, and hearing his cry had rushed out to find him lying on the stairs, but this was immediately questioned. In the first place, it was proved that from her room she could not have heard the struggle on the stairs, owing to the thickness of the walls, and the length of the intervening passage. Then it was evident that as he had not been in bed and asleep, since she was dressed when she roused the house, and her bed had not been slept in. Moreover, the door at the bottom of the stairs was ajar, and the key in the lock, and it was noticed by the chaplain, an observant man, that the dress she wore was stained with blood about the knees, and that there were traces of small blood-stained hands low down on the staircase walls, so that it was conjectured that as he had really been at the postern door when her husband fell, and, feeling her way up to him in the darkness on her hands and knees, had been stained by his blood dripping down on her. Of course it was argued on the other side, that the blood marks on her dress might have been caused by her kneeling down by her husband, when she rushed out of her room. But there was the open door below, and the fact that the finger marks in the staircase all pointed upward. The accused held to her statement for the first 2 days, in spite of its improbability. But on the third day word was brought to her that Herve de Landrevane, a young nobleman of the neighborhood, had been arrested for complicity in the crime. Two or three witnesses thereupon came forward to say that it was known throughout the country that Landrevane had formerly been on good terms with the Lady of Cornault, but that he had been absent from Brittany for over a year, and people had ceased to associate their names. The witnesses who made this statement were not of a very reputable sort. One was an old herb gatherer suspected of witchcraft, another a drunken clerk from a neighboring parish, the third a half-witted shepherd who could be made to say anything, and it was clear that the prosecution was not satisfied with its case, and would have liked to find more definite proof of Landrevane's complicity than the statement of the herb gatherer, who swore to having seen him climbing the wall of the park on the night of the murder. One way of patching out incomplete proofs in those days was to put some sort of pressure, moral or physical, on the accused person. It is not clear what pressure was put on Anne de Cornault, But on the third day, when she was brought into court, she appeared weak and wandering, and after being encouraged to collect herself and speak the truth on her honor and the wounds of her blessed Redeemer, she confessed that as he had in fact gone down the stairs to speak with her of the Landravine who denied everything and had been surprised there by the sound of her husband's fall. That was better, and the prosecution rubbed its hands with satisfaction. The satisfaction increased when various dependents living at Kerfel were induced to say with apparent sincerity that during the year or two preceding his death their master had once more grown uncertain and irascible, and subject to the fits of brooding silence which his household had learned to dread before his second marriage. This seemed to show that things had not been going well at Kerfel, though no one could be found to say that there had been any signs of open disagreement between husband and wife. Anna Cornault, when questioned as to her reason for going down at night to open the door to her of the Landravine, made an answer which must have sent a smile around the court. She said it was because she was lonely and wanted to talk with the young man. Was this the only reason? She was asked, and replied, yes. By the cross over your lordship's heads. At why at midnight? The court asked. Because I could see him in no other way. I can see the exchange of glances across the ermine collars under the crucifix. Anna Cornault, further questioned, said that her married life had been extremely lonely, desolate was the word she used. It was true that her husband seldom spoke harshly to her, but there were days when he did not speak at all. It was true that he had never struck or threatened her, but he kept her like a prisoner at Kerfel, and when he rode away to Morlakes or Quimper or Enns he set so close a watch on her that she could not pick a flower in the garden without having a waiting woman at her heels. I'm no queen to need such honors, she once said to him, and he had answered that a man who has a treasure does not leave the key in the lock when he goes out. And take me with you, she urged. But to this, he said that towns were pernicious places, and young wives better off at their own firesides. But what did you want to say to her of the Landravine? The court asked, and she answered, to ask him to take me away. I you confess that you went down to him with adulterous thoughts? No. Then why did you want him to take you away? Because I was afraid for my life. Of whom were you afraid? Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.